by the end of it, physically, I couldn't even walk. By that point, I was like so beyond textbook alcoholic, chemically addicted, beyond just, you know, anything else, that I was in real danger. And, you know, I was 18 years old and I was meant to be sitting my A-levels. And I always have this really specific memory of my mum going, Isabella, your school are asking if you're going to sit your exams. You can sit your exams or you can go to Oasis, which is the treatment centre in South Africa. And I said, oh, I'll go to Oasis. The cynical version of me is like, oh, I just decided to go to treatment so I could skip my A-levels. I decided to go to treatment because I realised that I actually wanted a life for myself by that point. I realised that I couldn't do it alone.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfor. In this podcast, I will speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I'll share my own story throughout these conversations. We speak to some really inspirational young people about how they personally have been affected by addiction and recovery, and some who have been surrounded by the addiction of others as a young person. We also speak with professionals who are working in the addiction and recovery youth sector. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Welcome back to This Is Powerful. We have an extraordinary guest today. Izzy got sober as a teenager and now is an inspiring example of how you can turn your life around if you really work a recovery program. Issa can trace the beginnings of her pattern of addictive behavior back to unhealthy eating when she was just 7 years old. Unhealthy eating led to a full-blown addiction to drugs and alcohol, bringing Issa into rehab by the time she was just 18. Hi, Issa. Welcome to This Is Powerful. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
We've had a good chat before. Now we need to carry on the conversation, basically. Issa, can I just ask you off the top of how sober you are?
3.5 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And how old was you when you got sober?
18.
God, that's such a good age.
It's
from my view.
Well, I think that's the thing. When I was, you know, in early recovery, I personally never really had this, but I was, you know, getting clean with a lot of other young people, whether it be through where I was in my, you know, sober house or going to the meetings I was going to. And some people had that reaction of, oh, you know, I hate when people tell me that, you know, you're so lucky to get clean.
Lucky is the wrong word.
Yeah.
I think it's more, it's a great time from a perspective of age, because I got sober at 33 and I could have done a lot better if I had got sobriety earlier. That's what it means.
Well, that's why I count my blessings. And I guess that's what I always said in response. Like, I look back at where I was and honestly, what would have happened if I didn't get clean when I did? And I wouldn't be sat here today if I hadn't have gotten clean when I did. So I'm grateful.
We're both grateful.
We're both grateful.
So can you tell me a little bit about you, like where are you from and your upbringing?
So I've grown up in London, Northwest London. Got one older sister. I'll get in trouble if I say she's 31. She's 30. She's turning 31. So yeah, just the two of us and then my parents. My dad's from Hull and my mum's from Venezuela. Kind of a nuclear family setup, but I think I kind of grew up more as an only child. The gap between my sister and I was quite big, you know, 9 years, and we were always at completely different stages. And she moved out when she was 18, so I was still really young.
Yeah.
And I think in that, when I look at how I grew up now, it's a different experience to what most, you know, two sibling households have. My dad traveled a lot for work when I was growing up, and that actually brought some really exciting things. Like, I covered a lot of the world before I could even really appreciate it, kind of following my dad around with his work. And, you know, my mum was at home helping to raise me when she raised me, basically. And I say, when I look back at my childhood, it was really quite colourful.
But in, it was in the sense of, like, because if it was just you and your mum, you mean, because when your dad come back and your sister and...
Yeah, I would say that my childhood was happy until I was around 8 or 9. I think that's when things really started to change for me. And I was raised in quite a different household to the majority of my peers. You know, my mum is very proudly Latin, and that meant that my sister and I were raised with a very strong Latin impression placed upon us. And, you know,
do you think that's a good thing, though? Because I think that's a nice infusion of culture.
It was an amazing infusion of culture. I mean, I'm very proud of my heritage. I'm very proud of where I come from. I think that, especially when I came into recovery, I was really able to reconnect with that. I think I probably felt a little bit, you know, growing up as a teenager, probably felt a little bit like, oh my God, mum, but all my friends' parents let me do this. And she'd be like, well, I don't know, care what your friends' parents say. You know, that kind of
sounds stuff. Like me as a parent.
And yeah, there was, you know, I think what it was rules and structure. Yeah. And that felt like injustice at times. I think the other thing that's part of our culture is a big impression on being proud of your appearance, what you look like, being careful about those things. And, you know, that was a big part of my upbringing too. And then on my dad's side, my dad is the happiest man in the world. He's just happy. He's just happy to be here. He's just happy to be around everyone. He is genuinely the most, he's my best friend. And it was two very different dynamics though growing up, especially with a parent who is away all the time and comes back. And, you know, what happens is they want to kind of like soothe the fact that they were away. But if you have one parent doing all the heavy lifting at home and then one parent coming in, and kind of sometimes it can feel like undoing all that work, because, you know, whether it's gift giving or being good cop, that did definitely cause some dynamics.
So I can tell you from my, so my dad was away a lot working, but for me it's funny because when my wife and I got together and then we had our first child, I was still modeling, so I was traveling a lot. And I used to come home and little one would be like, Daddy's the best, he's so much fun. And she would just look at me across the kitchen like, I've been here every day, holding fort, cooking, cleaning, now you're the hero. So it's been like the striker in the football match.
Yeah, but that is, I think this is the thing. It's like I sit here and I say, you know, my dad is my best friend and blah, blah, blah. My dad, I love him to pieces and we are so close, but I would not be where I am today without the ethos, the values, the morality, the work ethic, the strength that my mum gave me. You know, my mum is, she moved around a lot as a child. She had, honestly, quite a difficult childhood, and she got through all of that. And she took really big steps. She left Venezuela as a very young woman by herself. You know, she went to live in Italy. She speaks fluent Italian now. Like, she then went to live in Scotland with my dad after they met in Venezuela, and she didn't speak much English at all. She told me that one of the first places she learned English was in Glasgow, which was like
a particular type of English.
She says that the Glaswegians are her favorite people though. And she just took all these huge steps and like bravery and courage and being in the unknown and moving forward. And she has taught me so much. So when I look at the roles that my parents played in my childhood, they are different roles, but they've both given me so much. And the gratitude that I feel for that now that I'm in recovery and I have perspective is immense.
Yeah. It sounds like it. That's really lovely. I hope my daughter talks about me like that.
I'm sure she will.
I hope so. Or both of them.
After 19 years old.
Yeah. I always tell them there's like a gap we might not get on. Did you experience any drinking or anything around you when you was younger?
Yeah. My family are, it was really interesting. You know, the drinking that I experienced at home came in really two forms, three. I mean, you had the social drinking. My mum also only had like Latin or Italian or French friends, like very international. And it was very European or Latin sort of social setting. So that was all very normal. One thing that did happen is, you know, my dad's job was really difficult. And something that I did observe, and I'm sure he'd be fine for me to say this now, he's kind of, through me, engaged with, he's really interested in AA and what we do, although I'm not saying he's an alcoholic by any means, but I would see that when he was really stressed from work, he would have a gin and tonic as soon as he got home. And he would sit in the armchair in our living room and just have a gin and tonic. And that was like the first thing that registered. You know, I'm not saying it was all the time, but that was the first thing that registered. And then the other thing that came up a lot was football. So my dad is a massive Arsenal fan. He's from Hull, but his uncle Ben used to live near Holloway Road and used to take him to Arsenal when he came down. My dad's been going to Arsenal for 30 years and I've been going since I was around 3 years old. The same with my sister. So we go to every single game together. That's our thing. But obviously there's a huge drinking culture, and this is not just, you know, my dad. This is, you know, I can see it in lots of people.
Basically the stadium.
Yeah, it's like, I think people, life is hard.
Yeah.
And football brings so much joy, but also it's like this, let's rip off the band-aid, let's let loose, let's let all the air out. And that came through drinking. So I was exposed, I would say, to drinking in a positive light. Like, for me, looking at that, it was like, these people are all having so much fun. And I guess that was something that subliminally growing up was like this message starting to develop in my mind. And it's not that, you know, I'm saying, oh, I should have never been taken to football. But I think it was really interesting because I was so invested in it. It was one of the things with my dad that, because he was away so often, we would do together and that was our time. It is really interesting that how that developed. Like, it kind of got a good image for me.
It's a celebration, isn't it? And people do work hard. Not everyone has easy lives. And in our culture, anyway, alcohol always comes in with celebrations or funerals or passings or something. It's always there, isn't it? And it's one of the oldest things used for as a painkiller.
Yeah. I always have this really specific memory of being like at my grandfather's funeral. And he was just, my dad's dad, he was just the most incredible man, and he is still with me today, and in my heart. But I do just remember, you know, my family are also northern, so it's just part of it, like that side, like my dad's from Hull, so it's just part of it, but I do just remember that for the first time, I really saw everyone in so much emotional pain. But drinking was being used in a way to celebrate his life, but also really to quell what was going on inside. And by that point, you know, I was secretly engaging in my own stuff, but I hadn't necessarily had the courage yet to do it in front of other people. I was 14. And it will always stick with me. It will.
It's amazing how certain things register. And it's quite smart of that to register as well. when you was engaging in your stuff, do you mind talking about what it was and when that progressed?
Yeah, I think for me, food was the first thing. I'm tall. I've always been tall. I always felt like I really stuck out, like a sore thumb. I never felt like I fit in growing up. Never.
Because of your height or generally as
just
well?
Just generally. I always felt on the outside looking in. And this is from like a really young age, maybe, like from as young as I can remember. And I felt so lonely growing up. And, you know, that's not anyone's fault. That's just how I felt. And food for me was like a real escape. It was really, you know, I'd get up. I remember one time, you know, I woke up, I was probably around 7, 8 years old. And I woke up and it was a Saturday morning and my mum had bought Cheerios, like the honey ones, and that was like a treat. And I just remember like I snuck out of my room at 6 a.m. and ate the whole box with milk first thing. And that might sound like kids being kids, but I knew not to do that. And it was almost like this addictive tendency, like I couldn't not. And, you know, as I got older, as you know, when I turned 11, you know, I was quite overweight. I personally feel that I was. A lot of people are like, no, you weren't. I'm saying I was overweight.
That's your reality at the time.
That's my reality, yeah. And I just felt I was tall and I was big and I was just like, oh, this is just horrible. Like, please, you know, I was getting bullied at school and had some really horrific experiences that still haunt me today, even though I was only like 10. And I just would eat. I'd come home and for all that there had been an element about, you need to be careful about what you're eating because of my culture. And, you know, in Latin culture, we also call people like fatty. Like you're like, hola gorda. Like that's what you say. Like it's just culture. It's fine, you know? But there were elements of culture, but that was almost like the don't made me want to even more. And food brought me joy. So I'd get home from school and I'd have like, you know those 8 packs of brioche?
Yeah.
Just have like a whole one.
Yeah.
And then I'd make myself a smoothie and I'd have loads of crackers and I'd like just basically eat anything I could get my hands off. I was like emotionally eating every single day I got home.
Was you aware that it was classed as emotional eating or you just felt that you was comforted by the action of it?
I was comforted by the action. I was too young to know what was going on. This probably stopped when I was around 13, the real excessive eating. But it was like exciting. I was excited to go home and eat. And I was still too young to buy food at that point, but it just brought me safety. Food brought me so much safety, you know, at school as well. I loved my food growing up as well, just in a general sense. You know, when I was at school before I went to primary, you know, the lunch ladies who were so lovely used to tell my mum, you know, she ate all her food. And my mum's like, surprise, surprise. And I'm like, sick. And, you know, my relationship with it, one side, I just was the happy kid who loved to eat. But then behind closed doors, I was, it was like solace for me. So that's where it started. And then it progressed. You know, when I turned around 13, I was really overweight. I really felt like I was sticking out. I didn't know what to do with myself. And it kind of just got worse and worse until I really hit a breaking point and I went totally in the opposite direction. And I would, you know, force myself to basically not eat and walk, you know, ridiculous lengths every single day. So then I started starving myself. And my relationship, whilst my relationship with food was changing, obviously what comes with that is weight loss. And obviously with that, endorphins. And, you know, I'm happy and I'm just like, thank God I'm finally what I've wanted to be. Because this whole time that I was emotionally eating and putting more and more weight on, all I wanted to be was slim. So it was like this addiction to also self-sabotage. Even though the ideals that I had in my head maybe weren't right for, you know, a young child to have, it's all I wanted.
It must be very, very tough. We try and keep an eye on my girls because one of them loves food too. I can see she gets comfort out of it. And it's hard to balance it because you think, I know when I was younger, if I ate the whole plate, it was a pat on the back and like, oh, well done, he's strong, he's eating all his food. And that's okay. But if you've got something going on inside, that can be quite damaging.
Yeah. And you know what? I think it's also, I think about this, and you know, it is part of my culture. You know, my grandma will tell me, my aunts will tell me, my mum will tell me. Mm. My mum will tell me first, quite frankly. But it's also like they want you to tell them.
Mm.
It's not one-sided. If my mum thought, if, you know, my mum would want me to tell her if, you know, I thought she was putting weight on. So at the beginning, when I reacted to those comments, it was, you know, just a, I'll describe it as a cultural comment. It was, this is part of our culture. This is what we do. Get used to it. Like, this is it. But as it became more and more serious, I couldn't separate concern. I couldn't see it as concern because I felt that it was an unnecessary comment to do with, you know, the normalization of the comments before.
Did you find it painful and irritating when someone said something?
Yeah, because I knew. I knew. And I think that plagued me a lot. Like, I knew. And it felt like I couldn't really escape it.
When I've heard this from my mum, by the way, I did this whole thing about 15 years ago when I was 40. I'd go to her house and sometimes she'd just give me a little hug and I could feel her feeling my back or something. And she'd be like, oh, have you been to the gym lately? As if like this miraculous sentence just popped in her head. And one day I just sat her down and was like, listen, you've always come in, offered me something like a biscuit and then said, oh, you don't eat too much of them. Or have you been to the gym? Or you should go to the gym. Or, oh, today you're looking amazing. And it's this thing. And I had to say to her, listen, enough's enough. I know what you're saying. And I know why you're saying it, because you care. But you're actually doing a lot of damage. And she's never said anything since.
Mm.
When you flipped to trying to be slim, walking loads and starving yourself, basically, was there a reaction from your parents then?
This is going to sound quite shallow, and I don't think it's an accurate description of what the relationship was actually like, because, you know, I love my mum to pieces and she would do anything for me. Mm. But I remember one of the best days I have ever had with my mum, or one of the first that I can really remember as being like amazing, was when I was losing weight and we went shopping for clothes. And that was like, you know, for her, she was like, oh, she's losing weight, you know?
Mm.
She didn't necessarily know how I was doing it. They didn't know. But I just remember that validation. And, you know, like you just said about the feeling your back thing, like, again, this is a cultural thing, but like my mum would come in, well, she doesn't do this anymore. My mum would come into my room and like pat my stomach. And that used to happen all the time when I was younger. And that, compared to, you know, losing weight and going shopping with your mum. And my mum, by the way, can I just say, is a beautiful woman. She hasn't aged. I won't say how old she is because she'll kill me. But she hasn't aged. She's stunning. She's so I looked also at my mum as like this, just this beautiful presence. And to get validation from that, not just my mum, but someone who was so gorgeous and stopped people and, you know, that was everything for me. And from my side, how I viewed the relationship became like skewed. It became toxic. My brain was making it toxic. It was almost like fueling this thing of like, if I get slim, everything will be fine. And
I understand that, because in the modeling world, my nickname was Skinny when I started, because I had like naturally like 8% body fat because I couldn't sit still. If I wasn't running, I was doing handstands, or I was at the gym, or I was skipping. That was just me. I was like that anyway. And I naturally had a really good shape. So the validation I used to get from that, and the agents going, oh my God, look, you got no fat, you're great, you're this, you're that. And then when I moved to Milan, and I never used to eat pasta or carbs. And I remember I was living with Billy Phillips, this Italian-American guy, and he used to make these big, huge pots of sauce, and then just like, hey, come on, let's have an Italian night, and it was like bread and baguettes and stuff. And I remember I went from a size 20, it was just under 28 waist, to a 30, which was still slim. And I remember getting fitted, and he was like, oh, you you've changed. And they got the measuring tape out and measured me, and they were like, oh. And just the reactions from the people, that the sounds, I felt like I'd done something wrong. And from then I was never had body issues before. I had food issues, but I never really had body issues in that way. Something changed for me that day. I was like, okay. And it really made me self-conscious, because before I was quite proud of how I was.
Yeah.
And it made me really, like, you know, start looking in the mirror and getting really self-conscious for a long time.
Yeah. I genuinely thought that I was going to die when I would step on the scales and see that I had put on 0.1 of a kilogram compared to the day before. I couldn't function.
When you say die, as in because of the emotional impact of it, or because you was putting on weight and it wasn't a healthy thing?
From when I started starving myself and over-exercising, I would weigh myself every single morning, obsessively. And having that 0.1 added filled me with shame, disgust, hopelessness. Because all you want is to reach, or all I wanted at that time is to reach this goal, and I felt, why can I not do it? But it also just brought back all the complexes that I had around the shame that I had in eating in the first place, the way I did. I was so ashamed. I was a secret eater. I knew intrinsically that there was something wrong with it, because if I didn't, I wouldn't have gone into my room shoving, you know, an 8-pack of brioche and like 10 packs of crackers in my backpack and hiding behind my bed in the corner of my room, stuffing my face, and then kind of putting all the wrappers in my bag the next day and throwing them away before I got into school.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done that.
It's an early routine, isn't it?
And I replicated it with my drinking.
Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you. And to say, if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate, or review the show. And it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show. Where did the lack of food and exercise take you?
It joined me for the rest of my journey until I came into recovery. I went on this... Honestly, I mean, I think back to it now, I'm just like, how the hell did you do it? But every single day, you know, I'd be starving myself, over-exercising. Oh, by the way, you know, I had a period of about a year where in the evenings I do like 1,000 star jumps and sit-ups, like just insanity every single night. And that's what it looked like. I wouldn't eat anything. I used to allow myself to snack on like fruit and fiber, but like not too many of the raisins, because raisins have a lot of sugar in them. Mm. So I'm not allowed that. And in COVID, it got really, really bad and really, really obsessive. But my eating kind of then crossed over with my drinking. So then what happened is I would starve myself all day, and it just wasn't enough to keep me strong. And I just had engaged in my drinking by that point, you know, whether it be kind of secretly taking shots out of my dad's liquor cabinet, or, you know, having a bit too much to drink at a party. But then what started happening is I also had really bad sleep issues. And what started happening is I was like, I just need to feel better. So I used to go to this dodgy corner shop in Golders Green, and I used to trek from school across to Golders Green. Golders Green is out of the way for me. And I used to buy a bottle of Glen's, and I slowly and slowly, every night, I drink more of it. And it just got to this thing where every single evening, I would starve myself all day, barely have anything to eat. I'd get into this routine of watching 10 o'clock BBC News, be like, right, that's it, I've done it, I'm off to bed, and just neck a bottle of vodka. And I did that every day. And that's when the drinking started to take over, but also the foods, the starving stopped being enough. I was really engaging in my addictive tendencies, and all of my addictions started flaring up. And what then happened is, because I was realizing, I was sort of becoming nihilistic. I was like, why don't I just do what I want? Why don't I just eat what I want? And that's when the bulimia started. And then what would happen is, you know, I'd go to Golders Green, pick up the bottle of Glens from the dodgy corner shop. I'd then go to a Sainsbury's and fill my bag with all these things that for me were terrible foods, bad foods, shameful foods. And I used to binge, just binge. I'd get home from school, I'd do homework, whatever, I'd have dinner, and then I'd go to my room, I'd binge, and then I'd purge immediately after. And then after that, I'd kind of try and recalibrate, spend some time with my family, and then I'd go and drink a whole bottle of vodka. And then I'd go to school the next day.
How on earth did you do your school?
I literally don't know. By the end of it, I was going in drunk.
So what's sorry, what age was
if
this?
If anyone is watching, I'm sure they knew. yeah, sorry. I went to rehab at 18, and a lot of my drinking coincided, like, really got ridiculous during COVID, during both lockdowns. But I couldn't see that because at that time I was thin. I was thin by then. I was, obviously it was never enough, but I was dangerously thin for what I should be, for my height. And, you know, I was underweight and, you know, I was having the time of my life. I was kind of just like, it was really interesting. During COVID, there was a bit of a sod it attitude and people just went out and had fun in the summer. And I was there and my drinking was romantic at that point. Not really. But, you know, I also had an issue with pills and, you know, I was mixing and all this stuff. And then when I went back to school, it was kind of not too late, but I was in this routine and I obviously wasn't going to put it down. I mean, I'm an alcoholic addict. So no, that's not happening. So I don't know how I did it, but I just did it.
When you said pills, were they stimulants to?
No, actually, I had a real, because I've never slept well, as a child, like never. And I would take, my parents genuinely didn't know what to do with me. I mean, it would be like, I get an hour a night and then I go into school and then an hour the next, they just didn't know what to do. So they kind of, having exhausted all their options, like in really desperate times, when I was younger, would give me half a sleeping pill.
Yeah.
So Zolpidem or whatever.
Yeah, because it's terrifying if your child's not sleeping.
No, I was, I think genuinely they were terrified. And my mum is an insomniac and my sister has a really bad sleep issues as well. So it was running in the family, but I was obviously nine. So they were like, okay, we need to help her. And that's kind of where I got my first taste for it. I mean, I remember the euphoria of actually realizing that I was taking something addictive and feeling the side effects of it. And also with, you know, benzos, like diazepam, I had a huge problem with as well. So this was all happening at the same time. It was food, drinking, pills. And I'd only take pills at night, and I'd only take them after I'd had my first half of the bottle of Glens. And it was a science. It was like, it was just this formula.
A chemistry test just to get this perfect.
Perfect high that I will never, ever get again. Yeah. And I would never get that after the first time I had it. You know, it's like chasing this dream. It's a pipe dream.
Yeah. And really for, you know, for identifications for our listeners is that, for me, I felt like I was like this shattered glass bottle and everyone else was like this beautiful solid bottle and I wasn't, I was shattered.
Yeah.
And how I reacted to things was differently emotionally, and I was very soft and sensitive and I built up this veneer so that you couldn't hurt me, or I'd do sort of crazy actions to scare you, to show you that I'm actually a lot more tougher or crazy than you are to keep you away.
Yeah.
But inside just feeling completely in bits.
Yeah. I would go, like, by the time I was in year 12, it wasn't, you know, the day drinking hadn't really started by that point. Because there was a point where I was, you know, before that, it's like, okay, well, my breath would have smelt of alcohol, but I wasn't going in drunk. Even then, I think about where I was compared to my peers, to the friends that I had. I lost a lot of friends through my drinking.
What was the obvious feedback for their reaction to you?
I was just uncontrollable. Like, I was uncontrollable. I would just... I cannot reconcile who I was with who I am now.
Mm.
It's like... It is just Jekyll and Hyde. It's Jekyll and Hyde. My addiction turned me into, when I was drinking particularly, turned me into a person that I am. Look, I've done a lot of work on acceptance.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of apologies to make, a lot of amends. I cannot reconcile that I am who I was.
I totally understand that.
Yeah. I have grieved what I could have had, but quite frankly, that's not what happened.
Mm.
And I don't see any point in wasting time. I will always feel remorseful for my actions and always feel... Well, I always feel indebted to the people that tried to do what they could to help me, even though I hurt them in response.
Mm.
But I've learned that actually the world doesn't revolve around me. People don't sit there thinking about what I did every single day.
Mm.
People have their own lives and people move on. And quite frankly, I'm not the center of the universe. And I need to move on too. And actually, to make amends properly, I need to do living amends first and stay sober.
Yeah. And that's very grown up and that's very mature and wise thing to say.
Mm.
And it takes a lot of work to get to where you are. And you can tell you either do it or you don't do it.
Mm.
You know, to have that perspective and understanding. And it's easy. What's really dangerous for addiction is that... You know, I remember telling somebody something about being ashamed of a piece of behaviour and they said to get off the cross because someone else needs the wood. Like, don't be stuck in self about it because, again, you're forming another thought process that's damaging.
Yeah.
And therefore, once that's got hold of you, you'll then damage other people. So, yeah. Like, just stay on a clean path, right?
Yeah.
How did your parents try to deal with it? Because I'm just thinking of a parent's point of view as well, how I was. It must be very difficult for your daughter to be going down a path that they obviously don't want you to go down.
I think they dealt with it the only way they knew how. And the only way they know how, like, that varies between sets of parents.
Mm.
So parents think differently between every single parent. Like, there's different thinking involved. Between sets of parents, there's different thinking involved. One thing I will say is, you know, they were really scared of me dying because the situations that I found myself in as a result of my drinking, whether physical, whether situations that I put myself in because I'm drunk and I think it's a good place to end up in this location.
Mm.
Like, no, you know.
Wise thinking when you're drunk.
Yeah, wise thinking when you're drunk. But, you know, the situations that I put myself in, I cannot imagine how terrifying that must have been. I also will say that, you know, my family have not had it easy.
Mm.
And my dad has been... honestly, very sick multiple times over my life, whether with, you know, cancer, stroke, whatever it is. And I think it was kind of like, it had been a while since there had been a big thing, but also, you know, my mum was dealing with the loss of someone that she considered her sister at the same time. And, you know, that person really to me was like a second mother as well. And, you know, her daughter is like a sister to me. You know, she's a year older than me. We've grown up together. And there was so much going on. And I don't know how they didn't just disintegrate.
Yeah.
I don't get it. And I actually think about it now. And I don't think that there's no parent gets a manual on how to deal with this stuff. I'm just so grateful that through everything that happened, they didn't give up on me, because I think they would have really been entitled to. Like, I was, if either of them tried to stand in the way of me and my addiction, I was horrific. I was violent. I was abusive, verbally, physically. Like, you know, the amount of times I would wake up and my parents would be sat with me in hospital. I just remember, like, how desperately I wanted to go, but they just didn't let me. And obviously, because they haven't let me in those moments, I want to return back to normal life as quick as possible and pretend that everything's fine. It's like, right, well, yeah, I'm just going to go watch some TV. Everything's fine. We're back from the Whittington. Everything's fine. Everything's under control. But it's not. You know, my sister as well, traumatized, sorry for my language, but traumatized, and got me out of so many terrifying situations. I mean, she dropped everything for me, even when all I was doing was hurting all three of them. So I look at all three of them, actually, because my sister also took a bit on of a parenting. She took on a parenting role, too. I mean, she's 9 years older than me. Like, she was kind of more of a mum sometimes than an older sister, just because of the age difference. And no one knows how to deal with these things. They dealt with it in the best way that they could. They tried to get me all the help that they could. They were doing the right things. The problem was I didn't want the help. How can you help someone that doesn't want to be helped?
That's the key. That's the it's such the dark side of addiction, isn't it? It's so hard because it makes no sense to anybody anywhere involved. What do you think addiction actually is?
Well, obviously we call it, you know, a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a disease. And it needs to be treated. And that's why I keep going to my meetings. And that's why I stay in touch with my fellows. And that's why I check myself at every point. But for me personally, addiction took me out of myself. It helped me be free of everything. Even if I, you know, I thought alcohol was my best friend, it was my worst enemy, but it felt like my best friend. My mind shut off, and even if I was causing absolute chaos and damage, at least I wasn't having to think about the chaos and damage that I had no control over. And for me, that's what it did. I was in control, yet I had no control at all.
Powerful. I'm so glad you found sobriety.
Yeah, me too.
It's so incredible about how you can turn your life, really turn your life around.
Mm.
I'm so happy for your parents now.
Yeah.
What was the turning point for you?
This is really interesting. I mean, well, by the end of it, physically, I couldn't even walk. Like, my muscles were just gone. Obviously, shakes, everything. I mean, by that point, I was like so beyond textbook alcoholic, chemically addicted, beyond just, you know, anything else, that I was in real danger. My mental health was just at an all-time low. And, you know, I was 18 years old and I was meant to be sitting my A-levels. And I just kind of, at the time I was thinking, you know, my parents had tried to get me to go to treatment before and I'd said, you must be mad. But this time I was like, right, well, I've got, there's something bad happening here and I've got to do something. And I always have this really specific memory of my mum going, Isabella, your school are asking if you're going to sit your exams. You can sit your exams or you can go to Oasis, which is the treatment center in South Africa. And I said, oh, I'll go to Oasis. And for all that, I look back at that and, you know, the cynical version of me is like, oh, I just decided to go to treatment so I could skip my A-levels. I decided to go to treatment because I realized that I actually wanted a life for myself by that point. I realized that I couldn't do it alone. Mm. I realized that in ways I had tried to do it alone. I tried to control my drinking. I tried to be without drinking. You know, I tried to be only take this pill or only just, you know, binge or only drink, you know, past 5 p.m. Or, you know, I'd done all the controlling. I'd done all the methods. It would always end in carnage. And in that moment, I realized I just couldn't go on. And I say that, you know, in that moment as well, I was sat on the stairs and I needed a hand to get up because I didn't have the strength to pull myself up the stairs, go back to my room. That's where I was at.
God, your mum must have been, even if she didn't show it, just like, wow, so relieved.
So she was, and she really, I think she was the strongest person. I remember leaving for treatment and she just kind of kept a brave face. And I just remember walking down. And turning around and just her kind of waving. And I put her through so much. But I think we can both look back now and say, not necessarily everything happens for a reason, but it turned out fine.
It's the timeline is a long time and it's probably a lot of pain, but in the grand scale of things, when someone becomes well, and you've turned everything around for what you're doing, that payoff is, it's kind of, it's not worth it, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's a happy ending.
Yeah. She's just always also been the strong one in my family. Like, my dad is, like I said, happy-go-lucky guy. He just, you know, he's not the most emotionally capable person in the world, but he's just happy. And I think I would never say he became stony around emotions, but he definitely withdrew. He didn't want other people to see that he was struggling.
Yeah.
And that's one type of sort of holding things up. But with my mum, I think she held everything together by it seemed. I mean, it was kind of like she was holding two mountains from colliding into one another. That's what my mum felt like. She was really like the keystone of me getting well. And I just don't know how she did it.
You probably have that in you as well.
Yeah.
You know, because there's times when I've been through stuff And I've moaned about my father that he's like this still person that has no emotions. But I've realised that, thank God, I've inherited some of that in certain situations now.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. When you come out of Oasis, did you feel like... I never felt one day when I was liberated, but I did start to look at myself and think, bloody hell, you're actually okay. Like, you're doing okay.
Well, my time coming out of Oasis was interesting. I remember one of the therapists that basically said, you haven't surrendered. And I was like, how dare you say I haven't surrendered? Of course I've surrendered. And I'm leaving in 2 days, so don't say that. You know, I was meant to go for 3 months and ended up being there for 5.5. But I think I realised that at Oasis, you know, it was the first time actually in my whole life that I was getting to know myself.
Mm.
Because, you know, that time where you start to come to know yourself as an adult, I was getting to know the addict me. I was fueling myself with... I wasn't me. I wasn't my authentic self. Oasis was the first time that I'd been sober for like more than 2 days in, you know, maybe 5 years. So it was a shock to the system. I learned so much there. But as soon as I got to London, I relapsed. Relapse is part of my story.
Mm.
It's a big part of my story. Because actually, it meant that everything that I learned in Oasis... I was like, oh, wait, it does apply to me.
Mm.
I said, oh. And, you know, in there, I realized what was happening is I'm a people pleaser to the point that I genuinely believe what is coming out of my mouth. And that's what was happening there. And, you know, no one can save me from that. They tried. But they taught me so much. And then that's when I looked at Lions. And Lions, I'd already done my intake and... you know, the relapse kind of came out and they were like, we can help you through this, you know.
That's Lions Campus.
Lions Campus, yeah. I do have a moment where I was liberated. And I think that is honestly when I was at Lions Campus and I went to a meeting by myself for one of the first times. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was with a fellow. And we went to Pont Street AA and we sat in that big room and just hearing wisdom, but hearing opportunity. And I didn't see it as, oh, this is unattainable. I just realized my way has not worked.
Mm.
You know, I'm 18 years old. Half the people I know are on a gap year right now. I'm in rehab. My way hasn't worked. Try someone else's way for once. And when that clicked, life hasn't been easy. But thank God my problems today are not the problems that I had when I was using.
Mm.
Thank God, you know, my biggest problem today is, you know, physical pain or... thank God my biggest problem today is I'm having a really difficult time at university. Or thank God, you know, one of my problems today is I don't want to discuss this thing in therapy because it's painful. But it's like, thank God I'm not waking up in a stranger's car at 6 a.m.
Mm.
with no phone on me. Thank God. It's that simple.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
And I sound quite hardline. And I think sometimes, you know, when I say that to other young people I know in recovery, it's a bit like, oh, bore off, really.
Yeah, but when you just give an example of the car where life has been, you know that the metric system, of you know, to measure that is not a big problem.
Mm.
You can deal with that.
Yeah, I'm in control today.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for the mundane. You have no idea.
I'm so grateful. I know exactly what you mean.
I'm so grateful. I mean, you know, there was one time where I was like battered out of my mind and I ran away from home and I ended up on Edgware Road and my sister had to pick me up and like, I don't even remember that.
Hmm.
I don't remember much. And that's not because it was a long time ago. That's because I blacked out every time I drank. By the end of it, I was pouring bottles of wine into a water bottle and mixing it with Ribena. I was getting through and then going home and drinking vodka and like mixing with pills. And, you know, I was a mess. I was ruining my body. I was ruining my life. And I look back and I'm like, thank God these are the problems that I have today. I have opportunity today. There is a life for me. And I get to live it. And part of living it is having the normal problems that everyone has.
Yeah.
And sometimes those problems can feel just as bad as the problems I used to have. But I can put it into perspective and I can take a deep breath and I could say, you got out of that situation somehow. You're gonna be fine. And I think that's actually, when I look at my past, that's something that I can use my using for. It does give me strength when I struggle today.
Yeah.
This has happened. Something, someone protected you through it. You know, you've got this.
And that's really profound.
Mm.
We are nearly to the end of our conversation. I could talk to you for ages. Can you just tell us what you're doing at Lions Campus?
So I am a recovery assistant. And recovery assistants, when I was there, I basically do the same role. So what that is, I mean, it really depends. You have the administrative, which is, you know, kind of keeping on top of medication charts, overseeing medication, doing, you know, drug testing. Then, you know, I run a 12-step group every week. And then sometimes I'll run some of the other, you know, formatted groups, like a goals group. And then really a big part of it is just being there, to listen, being there to support, just being around. And it's amazing because, quite frankly, I know what it can feel like to be there. It's not fun all the time.
Yeah.
No one's like, yay, I'm in the sober house. I'm having the time of my life. Like, the reality is, difficult things have brought people there. And I think the one thing that I love most about my job is that I really get to connect, but also the people there do remind me of my foundations and what it was like. And I think it's really important in my recovery. And then the other part of the job is just being able to respond to crises.
Yeah.
And I think you get that anywhere. Yeah.
What would you say to any young lady who is struggling, has a secret food problem, issues, or maybe pills or alcohol?
There is a way out. Even if you can't possibly imagine it, there is a way out. And it's ready for you when you're ready to take it.
Just made me emotional when you were saying that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Reza.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation, which educates children about addiction through school talks and provides some basic support for those struggling with addiction. To find out more on what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate. Please donate. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction. It will help us to educate more young people, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you. See you next time.